Welcome to Podcastus, North American History Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Roof. This is episode 3, part 2 of our series on the Civil Rights Movement in St. Augustine, Florida. If you like the full experience and having things in order, I recommend you listen to part 1 of the series, but obviously that's up to you. Part 1 focused on the build-up to the Civil Rights Movement that swept across the U.S. in the 1950s and 60s. We didn't really touch on St. Augustine specifically until the end of the episode. Initially, I tried to jump right into the story of the freedom movement that became international news in 1963 and 64. But as I explained in episode 1, the reaction of the white community in St. Augustine seems completely unbelievable, unless you explain the 90-plus years that followed the end of the Civil War. These were the years that segregation was enshrined in law and enforced with horrific violence, with one goal in mind, to maintain white supremacy. Most Americans have a misconstrued view of what segregation was. Popular culture and the education system have left many of us with the view that segregation was a scattered inconvenience, you know, whites-only drinking fountains in the 1950s. But it was much more than that. The entire South, and some of the North too, was segregated. Schools, hospitals, hotels, restaurants, churches, beaches, everything. Whites and blacks, for the most part, were kept separate by law. The Civil War may have ended in 1865, but the culture and mindset didn't suddenly change because slavery was taken away. Instead, they were absorbed into the system that replaced slavery. Segregation. I'm going to stop myself here before I rehash all of the last episode, but I am going to include a section from Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail. I haven't come across anything else that transmits the raw emotion of what segregation was. The parts about Dr. King's children hit me hardest. I'll be using the abbreviation NGR instead of the N-word when it comes up. And it comes up here. Quoting Dr. King, quote, "Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your 6-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, and see tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness towards white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a 5-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-county drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored. When your first name becomes NGR, and your middle name becomes Boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs. When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with the inner fears and outer resentments. When you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness. Then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over, and men are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair." End quote. Now that's heavy, but it makes it a lot easier to understand why everyday working people were willing to risk everything, their jobs, their money, their education, even their lives, to defeat the system of segregation. We ended part 1 with Dr. Robert Hayling, the man who will eventually lead the freedom movement in St. Augustine, arriving in town in 1960. He'd just finished up medical school in Nashville, Tennessee, and came to St. Augustine to take over the dental practice of the recently deceased Dr. Gordon. Dr. Hayling had been active in the civil rights movement in Nashville, and witnessed the power of well-organized protest. The movement there had been led by people who'd become legends in the movement, John Lewis, C.T. Vivian, Diane Nash, and others. But he'd also seen the dangers the movement leaders faced when the home of African-American lawyer Z. Alexander Luby was bombed just across the street from his dormitory. Now, when Dr. Hayling arrived in St. Augustine, The city was still pretending that they didn't have any problems surrounding race, because they'd had no large-scale protests. Now, there were two very small anti-segregation protests that took place in St. Augustine in the year that Dr. Hayling arrived, but he had no involvement in them. The first was when a couple students, inspired by the Greensboro protests, staged an impromptu lunch counter sit-in and were quickly driven from the restaurant by a white mob. The other incidents etched in the history books because of who carried out the protest. Hank Thomas, who grew up in St. Augustine and was home on summer break from Howard University, had agreed with a couple friends to stage a sit-in at McCrory's lunch counter. But when the time came to meet, no one else showed up. So Hank sat down and staged a one-man sit-in. The experience was humiliating for him. St. Augustine's a small town, and unlike many places in the South and the North, the neighborhoods weren't completely segregated. Even in Lincolnville, known as the traditionally African-American neighborhood, some white and black families lived next to each other. People knew each other. And Hank, the first member of his family to attend university, had to explain to the confused manager what he was doing, and then had to tell him that he needed to call the police. The policeman who showed up knew Hank and found the entire situation amusing, even refusing to handcuff him when he put his hands out. His mother was mortified and apologized profusely for her son's behavior at the police station. The sergeant on duty that day was one of their neighbors. And as if all of this wasn't humiliating enough, the police thought that Hank's protest might be a sign he was insane. So his childhood doctor, Joseph Shelley, was brought in to conduct a sanity interview. Thomas was released and suffered the indignation of having everyone, white and black, laugh at his failed attempt to integrate the city. Hank's experience is a great example of why these movements were often led by someone from outside the town. And less than 3 years later in St. Augustine, that person would be Dr. Hayling, who had grown up in nearby Tallahassee. Taylor Branch's masterpiece, Pillar of Fire, puts it this way, quote, "It was difficult for confrontation to be taken seriously amid old hometown ties, and the spark of extraordinary personal challenge was more likely to ignite among strangers. As the new Negro dentist in St. Augustine, Hayling did not see a life story behind most faces in town." End quote. Dr. Hayling would eventually take a leadership role, but during his first 2.5 years as a new resident of St. Augustine, he focused on building a successful dental practice, and quickly succeeded. He continued the policy of treating white and black patients, and had the only integrated waiting room in the city. And this is one of the many examples of the ridiculousness of segregation, because Dr. Hayling couldn't eat in any of the restaurants that served white patrons, or enter the public library, or swim at the public beach. But white residents, including members of the KKK, still went to him to have their teeth fixed. At least they did before he asked for a piece of the proverbial pie in 1963. As his practice grew, Hayling no doubt paid attention to the freedom movement sweeping across the South in 1961 and 1962. In May 1961, the first group of freedom riders set off aboard a Greyhound bus from Washington, D.C. The interracial group of 13 headed south to challenge segregation laws and bus stations. On Mother's Day, Sunday, May 14th, they were all nearly killed in Alabama when their bus was attacked by Klansmen, some of whom were still wearing their church clothes. The windows on the bus were smashed out, and a firebomb was thrown aboard. As the fire spread inside the bus, Klansmen held the door shut, screaming that they'd burn them all alive. Luckily, something startled the attackers, likely a pistol shot from an undercover law enforcement officer, and the riders escaped the burning bus, only to be savagely beaten by the mob. The attack had been organized by the infamous Birmingham Police Commissioner, Bull Connor, who'd assured a local Klan chapter that they'd have 15 minutes to attack the activists before police stepped in. The Lincolnville section of St. Augustine was no doubt abuzz when word reached them that Hank Thomas, the young man who'd been laughed at only a year earlier, was one of the riders. He continued on the ride and was beaten and imprisoned, and then he did it all again when the second busload of activists headed south. Dr. Hayling likely recognized another rider from his time in Nashville, John Lewis, who in 2020 is serving his 17th term in the House of Representatives. Hank Thomas ended up serving in Vietnam as a medic, where he was wounded in combat and received a Purple Heart. I found a pretty amazing interview where he talks about racial tensions between white and black troops and the problem of fragging, where officers were shot by their own men. In the interview, he tells a story where he shot down a Confederate flag that one of the other men in the unit had run up the flagpole. He says he was almost court-martialed for the act, but he, along with the other black soldiers in the unit, explained to their commanding officer that they wouldn't be fighting for America under a racist symbol, and from then on, the unit didn't fly the Confederate flag again. In the same interview, he talks about fragging, where officers were shot by their own men for a multitude of reasons, one of which, according to Thomas, was racism. Although he made clear he never witnessed such an event, he'd heard about them, and explained one cause as follows, and I'm going to be using the abbreviation NGR here instead of the N-word, wherever it comes up, and it comes up here. Thomas is quoted as saying, quote, "That's when the Army realized it had a problem, and they began to work on it. I've written about it. I said the use of the word NGR was pretty common by some white officers. You can't do that when the man you're calling an NGR has a machine gun. Some of them found out the hard way." End quote. After he left the Army, Hank Thomas moved to Atlanta and became one of the most successful African-American businessmen in the country. He's owned restaurants and hotels, and at the time of this recording, he's still active in the civil rights movement. As 1963 began, St. Augustine's leadership was still trying to pretend they didn't have any problems surrounding the issue of race. But the local NAACP chapter, led by Fannie Fullwood, didn't agree. They continued to press for a meeting with city leaders to discuss desegregating the city, and the leaders continued to refuse. It's not as if the leaders of St. Augustine weren't warned that they were facing an incredibly volatile situation. In 1963, the report of the Florida Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights went out of its way to single St. Augustine out when they said, quote, "Civil rights conditions in St. Augustine are considerably worse than in most, if not all, other cities in the state." It labeled St. Augustine as a, quote, "segregated superbomb aimed at the heart of Florida's economy and political integrity." It added that, quote, "the fuse is short," end quote. But taking action would have required strong leadership in local government and in the business and religious communities. And for some reason, St. Augustine lacked good leadership on all levels. Other cities across Florida, such as Orlando and Daytona Beach, had seen the writing on the wall and began the process of desegregation before things spiraled out of control. But St. Augustine was run by an extremely conservative group of men, heavily influenced by the John Birch Society, a right-wing group that saw communism and conspiracy theories everywhere. These leaders and the Birch Society falsely equated civil rights for African Americans with communism and refused to even discuss the issue. They, along with most of the white citizens, weren't prepared for a change of heart around the issue of segregation, and they certainly had no interest in federal intervention. In years prior, there would have been little hope for a civil rights movement to succeed in a place like St. Augustine. Remember, change in the South came from either a moral awakening combined with strong leadership or federal intervention, which usually only came as a result of sustained extreme violence. For a Northern president to send troops into a Southern city, things had to be very bad. It had happened before. Over 20,000 federal troops had been called in to put down the 1962 Ole Miss riots, in which thousands of white students and community members raged against the enrollment of the first black student. In the end, two civilians, including a reporter, were killed by the mob, and over 300 police and civilians were wounded by gunfire and violence. But St. Augustine had seen nothing along these lines, so there was little chance of federal involvement, which is why the institution of segregation had existed for so long. But in 1963, St. Augustine's leaders left themselves exposed to the possibility of at least a small amount of federal intervention, without extreme violence, all because of a birthday party. More specifically, who'd been invited to the party and who hadn't been. 1965 was the 400th anniversary of the founding of the city, its quadricentennial celebration. I have a lot of trouble with that word, so please bear with me. Now, local and state leaders, along with the business community in St. Augustine, were planning a blowout celebration, with an eye on tourist dollars. Old buildings were to be renovated, massive parties were being planned, and improvements were being made across the city. But this all had to be paid for, so they'd requested hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal aid. And this is where they'd left themselves exposed. Because all the planning that had already taken place, and every party and event to come, was to be 100% segregated, even though African Americans had been in St. Augustine since the 1500s and made up roughly 20% of the town's population. The planned segregated events included a huge party scheduled for March 1963, to be headlined by the Vice President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson. On February 26, 1963, a representative for the NAACP in St. Augustine mailed a letter from the local post office. It was addressed simply to John F. Kennedy, President of the United States, the White House, Washington, D.C. The letter began, quote, VP Lyndon Johnson, we understand that you have accepted an invitation to visit St. Augustine, Florida, the oldest city in the United States, on March 11, 1963, to serve as principal speaker for the dedication of the Avero site, sponsored by the St. Augustine Historical Society. Please allow us to inform you that the planning committee and welcoming committee for this event do not include representation from all the population segments of the city. In short, they are segregated. Perhaps this is not difficult to understand when one considers the fact that both the city of St. Augustine and St. John's County still maintain segregation in their public facilities. Moreover, all public schools are segregated, and the county has not yet appeared to undertake any effort to formulate a positive plan to comply with the May 1954 Supreme Court decree outlawing segregated public schools. End quote. Now the letter goes on to detail federal grants that have been given to the local hospital, which is still operating as a segregated institution, and gives other examples of federal money supporting segregation. The letter closed with, quote, we are requesting that you reconsider the invitation extended to you for an appearance here at the dedication of the Avero site on March 11th. Unless the nation's oldest city, St. Augustine, gives concrete evidence of a sincere desire and effort to comply with federal laws relating to the abolition of segregation. The St. Augustine branch of the National Association of the Advancement of Colored People anxiously awaits your reply. End quote. Vice President Johnson's simple response came soon after he read the letter. He responded, quote, no event in which I will participate in St. Augustine will be segregated. End quote. Johnson's response shocked everyone of every race in St. Augustine. The white leaders were furious. They were desperate for federal funds for their celebration, and they also wanted the prestige of the vice president coming to their city. But they also had to stick to their states' rights mantra of not caving into northern pressures on integration. The African American population was shocked because now they had to figure out what that meant. Did it mean that the city would have to integrate before the vice president would visit? Did it mean that all the whites-only signs would be coming down? Within the NAACP, Robert Hayling, who was now the leader of the local youth council, was pushing for direct action. He wanted to lead young black protesters onto the streets while the vice president was in town. The prospect of this horrified city leaders and the office of the vice president. The civil rights struggle is often presented as cut and dry. You know, protests led to change, but the number of moving parts in the movement was incredible. The moments leading up to Johnson's arrival show just how complicated the situation was. First off, you had divisions within the NAACP. Robert Hayling is butting heads with national leaders. He's ready to lead people onto the streets, whether the local and national leaders agree to it or not. And the national leaders of the NAACP are telling Hayling to get in line, and that he's not allowed to protest unless they specifically instruct him to do so. Local white leaders are furious that they've been put into this situation. They're being told by people representing the vice president that they're going to have to allow African Americans to attend the gala celebration. Now, the celebration's being held at the Ponce de Leon Hotel, the fanciest spot in town. Now, this is mind-blowing to think about, but in 1963, no black person in St. Augustine had ever entered a place like the Ponce de Leon unless they worked there. State leaders, including the governor, didn't want to anger the president, but also didn't want to be seen as capitulating to the federal government. But they wanted the money, and the prestige of a vice presidential visit. There were real divisions within the black community, too, often falling along generational lines. High school and college kids were more likely to support Hayling's desire to march. They were watching movements unfold all across the South, and they wanted action, not court cases like the NAACP tended to favor at the time. In the end, the vice president arrived, but the negotiations went down to the wire. They were made even more dramatic by the fact that they're taking place in NAACP leader Fannie Fullwood's home in Lincolnville. Miss Fullwood was a cleaning lady for one of the commanding officers at a nearby military base, and while it's safe to say that he knew she was the leader of the local NAACP chapter, he'd probably have been shocked to know that the reason she was late to her job that day was because she was busy leading negotiations in her living room between the NAACP and the chief aide to Florida Senator Smathers, along with George Reedy, who represented the Vice President of the United States. In the end, only a couple hours before the dinner began, a settlement was reached, and Robert Hayling reluctantly agreed to call off street protests. Two tables at the dinner were reserved for African Americans, and the day after the event, the city commission agreed to a meeting to listen to the NAACP's concerns. You have to understand how terrifying it would have been to be one of the 10 representatives who volunteered to attend the event at the last minute. They began receiving threats as soon as word spread through town that they were going to be attending. This was the first time there would be an integrated event like this in the city. But they went. They were met at the front door and escorted through the shocked onlookers by George Reedy, the aide to the Vice President of the United States. That night, Vice President Johnson stopped at their table and shook hands. Before he walked away, Dr. Hayling pleaded, quote, "Don't forget us, Mr. Vice President," end quote. The next day, 9 representatives from the NAACP, including Dr. Hayling, arrived for their meeting with the city commissioners and were shocked to discover an empty room with a tape recorder. A city employee informed them that the commissioners couldn't make the meeting and that they were instead to record their grievances on the tape recorder. Now, it's clear at this point that city leaders had no idea who they were dealing with regards to Robert Hayling. And to be fair, Hayling himself probably didn't know what he was capable of either. In a more progressive city, it's likely that he'd only have been known as a good dentist, and not the civil rights leader that he'd become. But he wasn't there yet. St. Augustine transformed him into a civil rights leader. But it was in him, whether he knew it or not. If you could have put together a Southern racist focus group back in 1963 and asked them to describe the characteristics they feared most in a black person, they'd likely have described Robert Hayling to a T. First off, he was a Southerner, born and raised in Tallahassee, Florida. Close enough to understand St. Augustine, but far enough away, as I quoted earlier, to not see a life story behind most faces in town. He was also a veteran. He'd served in the U.S. Air Force and had spent years in the North. Many in my hometown of Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. As a college student, he'd also spent summers in New York City, so he understood that segregation wasn't the norm everywhere. He was also highly educated. Obviously, he's a dentist. His father was also a professor. But what made Dr. Hayling most dangerous was something that can't be taught or learned. He was fearless. Some people get knocked down and crawl away, never to be seen again. Others get up with their eyes cast down and fall in line. And then there's the few like Hayling, who get up and look their tormentor in the eye and make them do it again and again and again. Every repressive action the city made against him and the black population in the summer and fall of 1963 pushed him closer to the point of no return. In the 2 months that followed the tape recorder incident, he pushed harder for direct action, but was held back by the NAACP. On June 16, 1963, city leaders finally did meet with the NAACP leaders, largely because they realized Dr. Hayling was going to be leading protests if they didn't. The meeting was an absolute disaster, highlighted by the sheriff, L.O. Davis, who explained to the NAACP representatives that the fight for civil rights couldn't go forward because it was simply a communist plot and it had to be stopped. He read from a conspiratorial magazine article that supported his claim. Now, while he read the article, he replaced the word Negro with the N-word. Dr. Hayling protested his use of the word, but he continued using it until a local businessman in attendance suggested he stop and use Negro instead. Asked about how the meeting went, Hayling, in reference to the sheriff being asked to say Negro, was quoted as saying, quote, "Someone learned a new word today," end quote. He then added, more seriously, that he would be willing to, quote, "spend my last dime to defeat segregation in St. Augustine," end quote. Now, hanging over the meeting was news that the Kennedy administration had introduced civil rights legislation in D.C. earlier that would ban segregation by private businesses. The attendees had no way of knowing that the coming struggle in their little town would be instrumental in the passage of what is now known as the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, ironically, the local Ku Klux Klan was also furious about the meeting, but they were angry that the government representatives had met with the black residents in the first place. They didn't care that the meeting had been a complete disaster. They didn't think it should have taken place. Hailing soon found himself the target of death threats. Now, this was standard operating procedure during segregation. Any African-American who challenged the status quo, or as Twine had said, asked for a piece of the pie, faced intimidation and threats like Hailing was receiving. If the threats failed, the machinery of segregation turned to violence. Only 4 days before the disastrous meeting in St. Augustine, Medgar Evers, the Mississippi NAACP leader who'd fought for his country on the beaches of Normandy during World War II, had been assassinated in his own driveway. He'd refused to stop fighting for the right to vote, and it had cost him his life. Now, Dr. Hailing didn't respond well to death threats. In fact, his response is like something out of an action movie. He issues a statement that local blacks have armed themselves and won't be getting killed like Medgar Evers. Instead, they'd, quote, shoot first and ask questions later, end quote. Now, this statement ricochets across the South, which is one of the many ironies of the era. Most white Southerners reacted as if his statement had come out of left field. The media spun it, and soon the story was that African Americans were arming themselves to attack whites. Now, if this was a movie, this is where things start to get dark. This is where we see the page get turned in the Southern segregationist playbook. Things go from threats and denial to action, arrests and escalating violence. One of the interviews I read talked about people in the town having two sides. They talked about the two sheriff L.O. Davises. There was the sheriff who was friendly with the local black population before the movement began. And then there was the sheriff who attacked nonviolent protesters with dogs and cattle prods, and had his morning coffee with Klan leaders after the movement gained steam. It's a side of this era that's rarely talked about. What it would have been like to live through this societal Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde scenario. Before the protests began in small town like St. Augustine, things obviously weren't great for African Americans, but they were living their day-to-day lives. They worked, went to church and school, they had relationships with white residents, especially in places like St. Augustine, where the neighborhoods weren't completely segregated. But once the protest movements began, everything changed. Black citizens soon saw how their neighbors really felt about them. People they'd known their entire lives became hostile to them because they were demanding the same rights that the white residents had. There's a lot of really heartbreaking aspects to this era, but this seems so cruel. I've been around long enough to know there's always going to be idiots. I don't understand someone assaulting someone because of the color of their skin, but I can chalk it up to maybe mental illness or someone being raised in a terrible family. But how do you explain away a neighbor who's been friendly with someone for years, turning their back on them and their kids because they want a better education for their child or to be able to sleep in a hotel? How does an entire town remain silent after a minister's home is firebombed, which will soon take place in St. Augustine? I came across a great quote from Mrs. Gordon, the widow of Dr. Gordon, whose practice Dr. Hailing took over. It touches on how black St. Augustinians viewed their white neighbors in the years after 1963 and 1964, when the violence subsided. She said, quote, "A lot of people have not gotten over the bitterness. Black people really had an opportunity to see firsthand what some people thought about them. It is one thing to think what somebody thinks about you, but it's another thing to think someone is going to jump out of the bushes and hit you." End quote. The weeks and months after Dr. Hailing announced he'd be willing to spend his last dime are when the protests got going. Most of the protesters were young, high school kids and college students from Florida Memorial College. They engaged in sit-ins and picketed segregated businesses. This is also when the violence stepped up. Local thugs started terrorizing African Americans in the Lincolnville section of St. Augustine. The violence escalated quickly, from throwing rocks to fights to African Americans having their cars and homes shot up. Not surprisingly, some shot back. But even with small-scale shootouts happening, the police did nothing to stop the violence. Instead, they focused their attention on arresting peaceful protesters. St. Augustine relied on trespassing laws to enforce segregation. That way they could half-heartedly claim that they weren't really segregated. But if a black person entered a white establishment and requested service, they were arrested for trespassing. On July 18, 1963, a group of African-American high school students were arrested at the Woolworth's lunch counter. When they were brought to court, the local judge, Judge Mathis, informed them and their parents that they had a choice to make. They could sign a legal document stating that their children wouldn't participate in another protest until they were 18, and agree to testify that Dr. Robert Hailing was guilty of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, or their children would be sent to reform school, which was in effect prison. Four of the families refused to sign. Audrey Edwards, Joanne Ulmer, Willie Singleton, and Samuel White remained incarcerated until January 1964. They came to be known as the St. Augustine Four. Dr. King referred to them as my warriors. As July rolled into August, the protests in St. Augustine and dozens of other cities across the South continued, and so did the violence. On August 28, 1963, Dr. King delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington. It's also around this time that Fullerwood Elementary School in St. Augustine finally got around to desegregating and let a few African-American students begin attending school there. Within 2 months, three of the families who'd sent their children to Fullerwood had their homes firebombed. On Labor Day, September 2nd, the protest movement in St. Augustine changed when a group of adults joined the protest held at the plaza in the center of St. Augustine. Before this protest, the movement's foot soldiers had been made up almost entirely of students, but the plight of the St. Augustine Four motivated many adults to join in. The local police moved quickly and arrested over 20 protesters, focusing specifically on the leaders, including Dr. Haling. Police used dogs and electric cattle prods on the nonviolent protesters. Now, if they thought this was going to make the movement and Dr. Haling retreat, they were wrong. 13 days after the Labor Day protest, the Ku Klux Klan bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, killing Addie Mae Collins, age 14, Cynthia Wesley, 14, Carol Robertson, age 14, and Carol Denise McNair, age 11. The murder of the four children shocked most of the nation, but not everyone. Around the second week of September, advertisements began to appear in the local St. Augustine paper that a Ku Klux Klan rally would be held on September 18, 1963. In the days leading up to the rally, Dr. Haling worked tirelessly to get local media to cover the fact that this hateful group was meeting outside their town. But in the end, no one agreed to report on the event. The date of the Klan rally fell on the same day that Dr. King delivered his eulogy at the funeral service for three of the murdered girls. Now, I quoted a portion of this eulogy in part one of the series, but I'm including a bit more this time. In his eulogy, Dr. King lays out the challenges faced by the movement and draws a line in the sand. He makes it clear that it's time for everyone who knows that segregation is wrong to act. Now, as you listen to this, reflect on the fact that as Dr. King stood and delivered these words, standing in front of the open coffins of three murdered girls, hundreds of Klan members and their supporters, their wives and children, were preparing to gather around a burning cross just outside of St. Augustine. Dr. King's eulogy included the following, quote, "These children, unoffending, innocent, and beautiful, were the victims of one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity. And yet they died nobly. They are the martyred heroines of a holy crusade for freedom and human dignity. And so this afternoon, in a real sense, they have something to say to each of us in their death. They have something to say to every minister of the gospel who has remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows. They have something to say to every politician who has fed his constituents with the stale bread of hatred and the spoiled meat of racism. They have something to say to the federal government that is compromised with the undemocratic practices of Southern Dixiecrats and the blatant hypocrisy of right-wing Northern Republicans. They have something to say to every Negro who has passively accepted the evil system of segregation and who has stood on the sidelines in a mighty struggle for justice. They say to each of us, black and white alike, that we must substitute courage for caution. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, and the philosophy which produced the murderers. Their death says to us that we must work passionately and unrelentingly for the realization of the American dream." End quote. Now, that passage includes the sentence that I talked about in part one of our series, which is, "They say to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murderers." In part one, I described that sentence as the Rosetta Stone of understanding race relations in the South, and much of the North too, because segregation wasn't the result of a few individual segregationists. When I was in school, it was always presented as if the South had a few segregationist leaders like Bull Connor who were responsible for the race problems, but everybody else was fine. But that's not the case. Virtually every leader in the South was a segregationist, because segregation was everywhere. It was, as Dr. King said, a way of life. Hours before the Klan rally began, Dr. Robert Hayling decided he was going to drive to the edge of the rally and watch from a distance. The decision almost cost him his life. The Klan rally that night featured a high-profile speaker, a racist minister named Connie Lynch. Lynch was from California and was well known for his ability to whip crowds into dangerous mobs. All across the country, anywhere racial tension surfaced, Lynch usually appeared. And this is another example of how different this era was, because citizens in places like St. Augustine raised money to bring men like Connie Lynch to their town. It's tough to describe how awful Connie Lynch was, but I found some audio of him. Now, I'll warn you, it includes the N-word. This is a clip of him at a segregation rally in St. Augustine in 1964.
And I'll say this to the stooges that want to take this back to the enemy's camp, to the niggers and all of their cohorts, that we white people are going to rise up 140 million strong.
And this clip is Lynch speaking at a press conference in 1964 in St. Augustine. Now, the press conference was held the day after a white mob that Lynch had whipped into a violent frenzy had sent 19 peaceful protesters to the hospital with serious injuries.
I spoke for the white people. The white people rallied behind it, and we kicked the living hell out of the niggers, sent the out-of-town niggers to the hospital and out of the state, back to their own hometowns where they ought to have been, and the niggers in St. Augustine got quiet and went back over Niggertown where they belong.
We have a detailed account of what transpired at this Klan rally outside of St. Augustine, because a man named Irvin Cheney, who was a minister, was there that night. He was against segregation, and he wanted to see what went on at a Klan rally. Irvin Cheney was wearing a recording device, which is why we have the quotes from Connie Lynch's speech that night. Now, I'm going to read some of it, and again, I'll be using the abbreviation NGR instead of the N-word. In this passage, Connie Lynch gives the Klan's view of what happened after the Civil War during Reconstruction. And this is important to grasp. I talked earlier about how Southerners viewed the era of Reconstruction as an occupation and referred to the Northerners who came south as carpetbaggers. Even today, groups like the Sons of Confederate Veterans use slogans like, "We don't reconstruct, we reload," all the while claiming that they're not a racist group. Now, after you hear what Connie Lynch had to say about Reconstruction, the argument that race isn't a factor for groups that use phrases like, "We don't reconstruct, we reload," becomes more difficult to make. Here's some of what Lynch said that night. Quote, "My friends, I want to share with you something of the history, the glorious history of the Klan. The Klan was born out of bloodshed, out of a real need to protect the Southern white man from the carpetbaggers, the Jew carpetbaggers. You know, of course, that the carpetbaggers were Jews, and they came down here and teamed up with the NGRs and tried to take away everything the white man had. But they learned that the white man would not take this line down. He organized. He organized into clans. He rose up to defend his honor and his interests. And I'll tell you that to this day, the Jews, the NGRs, and all the rest of the colored people are not afraid of anything else, but they are afraid of the Klan. For the last 30 years, the Klan has not been strong, has not been militant, but the Klan is on the move again, and it is not going to let the NGRs and the Jews take over the country." End quote. And if that wasn't horrible enough, he also spoke about the four girls who'd been killed in the bombing in Birmingham. And remember, this is the same day that Dr. King had presided over their funerals. Referencing the dead girls, Connie Lynch said, quote, "They scream and cry about these dead animals in Birmingham. The NGRs started the war. And when you start a war, you expect some to die. More will die, and you'd better be ready to see to it that they do. I'm speaking for God, and you'd better listen." End quote. And then Lynch turned his wrath on Dr. Robert Hayling, who at that very moment was on his way to observe the rally from a distant road. Speaking of Hayling, Lynch said the following, quote, "I'll tell you something else. You've got an NGR in St. Augustine that ought not to live. That burr-haired bastard of a dentist, he's got no right to live at all, let alone walk up and down your streets and breathe the white man's free air. He ought to wake up tomorrow morning with a bullet between his eyes. If you were half the men you claim to be, you'd kill him before sunup. End quote. After Lynch had whipped the crowd into a frenzy with his calls for murder, the rest of the speakers were dull, and according to Irvin Cheney, people started to leave the rally. But there were still over 100 people there when someone screamed, NGRs, NGRs. Cheney describes a mad rush as Klan members grabbed guns, bats, and knives. And then he saw what had caused the commotion. A number of Klan members were leading four black men at gunpoint toward the rally. Dr. Haling, Clyde Jenkins, James Hauser, and James Jackson had been driving down a dirt road on the edge of where the rally was being held when a man with a shotgun had stopped the car and demanded they get out. Dr. Haling immediately recognized white patients of his in the crowd. And it wasn't long before someone screamed that he was the dentist that Connie Lynch had demanded be murdered. Irvin Cheney writes that the whole situation was so surreal that he initially thought it had been staged, that it couldn't be real. But that thought only lasted a few seconds. At first, no one struck the four men. They stood calmly as Klan members shouted back and forth. But then women and children at the rally began taunting the men, who so far hadn't touched the four black men. Someone stepped forward, and the horrific assault began. Irvin Cheney slipped away to his car and drove to a payphone where he called the sheriff's office, State Highway Patrol, and the FBI in hopes that someone would get there to end the violence. Three of the men were horribly beaten. The assailants used bats, axe handles, fists, and then whipped the men with chains. Dr. Haling had 11 teeth smashed out, his ribs broken, and his right arm mangled. He remembered the crowd screaming that he was a right-handed dentist. They wanted to end his career. Their broken bodies were piled on top of each other on the stage. Someone picked up the microphone and screamed, "Has anyone ever smelled an NGR burn?" A cry went up for gasoline. They were going to be burned alive. It was at this moment that Sheriff L.O. Davis stepped out of the darkness and stopped the violence. Davis claimed he'd come as soon as he got the call. But at least one source I came across said he'd been at the rally the entire time, which isn't hard to believe, because in the coming year, most mornings he'll have his coffee with a Klan leader. Dr. Haling and the two other badly beaten men were taken to the hospital. Rosalie Gordon, the widow of Dr. Rudolph Gordon, the man whose practice Dr. Haling had taken over, wanted to get Dr. Haling out of St. Augustine immediately. She knew he was still in real danger. In a later interview, she said, quote, "I had a feeling that they were going to finish him. That is the way the Klan operates." End quote. She contacted her late husband's Phi Alpha fraternity brothers in Jacksonville. They were doctors and dentists. The men arranged for him to be moved immediately to Jacksonville, where he remained hospitalized for 2 weeks. In the same interview, Rosalie Gordon talks about the effect that the beating had on Dr. Haling, saying, quote, "I think he was so bitter that he decided then and there that if he lived, he would do something about it. So that was his everyday dream, from then until it was over." She continued, "I think that from then on, he planned his strategy to get them, to straighten out this situation, because this should not have happened." End quote. In part three of our series, the situation in St. Augustine explodes and becomes international news. Dr. Haling refuses to back down as Klansmen from across the country stream into town. And as the violence continues, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the SCLC team answer Dr. Haling's pleas for help and join the freedom movement in St. Augustine. Thanks for listening.